At some point, especially when things aren't going well, most of us wonder what life's all about. We ask ourselves questions like, why me? Or what have I done to deserve this? The questions are universal, and whole philosophies have been constructed on them. Those with a practical turn of mind may believe that philosophy is a waste of time, and that religion is merely a drug to keep much of the population quiet. According to some experts, there is nothing in the universe but the interplay of blind chance and the laws of physics. Everything, they say, is ultimately reducible to the machine-like interaction of matter and energy, with even these being interchangeable if the conditions are right. Mind, or consciousness, according to them, does not come into it at all, being merely an outgrowth of chemical processes occurring in the brain. Nevertheless, mind continues to be important to most of us, and we continue to ask ourselves questions about the meaning of it all. Why do we do this? We tend to question things only when life is difficult or traumatic in some way. It's as though we believe that somehow life should be smooth, uneventful, and full of contentment. Paradoxically enough, at the same time, we want it to provide us with excitement and stimulation, which is an impossible balancing act. The fact is, as the Buddha said, there is suffering, and there seems to be very little we can do about it other than to accept it. Birth is suffering, growth is suffering, old age is suffering. Not to get what we want is suffering. To experience what we don't want is suffering. There are so many symptoms of this kind of distress, most of which make us feel that there is something wrong with us or with the patterns of our lives. The problem may be something as simple as not having enough money to do what we want. It could be that we can never seem to find the perfect partner. Or maybe it's our working conditions that are getting us down. But it's not easy for us simply to accept that such suffering is an inevitable part of living. We are strongly drawn to the idea that things can be better, much better, than they are. We search for ways to minimize a problem, or if possible, to eradicate it completely. Finding a job stressful, we look for another. Believing that our general environment is the problem, we move away, even emigrate, to find superior living conditions. Experiencing difficulties in a relationship, we end it and seek another, better one. It rarely dawns on us that looking for lasting improvements in most of these areas is a very short-term solution. A new job may offer opportunities that the old one did not, but it is certain to be less than perfect. We always find that we have to compromise on the perfection we are looking for. The same is true of any area of life experience. We can never get it 100% to our satisfaction, no matter how hard we try. There is always something that is, at the least, not quite right, and at the worst, almost unbearable. As the Buddha said, there is suffering. When this realization dawns fully, it's common for an individual to experience a sense of deep and abiding futility. After all, what happiness could we find if, as seems to be the case, everything we do, everything we experience, is seriously flawed? It can seem as though the entire world is an alien environment where one is forever a stranger. A few develop a strong yearning to have done with the whole sorry mess. Usually, this becomes a longing to discover what lies behind appearances, to see what is really at the very roots of life. Nothing else matters. This quest becomes the only thing that occupies our hopes and dreams. I call this yearning the call of the beyond. But how could such a longing arise if life is as mechanistic as some scientists and philosophers suggest? What possible mechanism could there be for the existence of this summons to deep inquiry? Matter and energy on their own are scarcely enough to prompt it. Is it a delusion, as those who hold to a mechanical model of the universe would claim? If so, then we're in very good company. For the overwhelming majority of human beings believe that there is something more to the world than meets the eye. The only thing that makes sense is that there is something other than pure mechanism and blind chance, that the universe includes subtler dimensions than we can see with ordinary eyes. It begins to look as though we should include consciousness as a force at least as major as any other. In fact, perhaps the universe is better described as matter coexisting with consciousness, each of them being ultimately indestructible and equally important. The Buddha said that suffering has a mental cause, that there is a major condition of consciousness dependent upon which it arises. Notice that this runs exactly counter to the mechanistic view of the universe, which tends towards the idea that suffering arises from only from an imbalance in material forces, whether they be genetic, economic, or natural, as in disease, floods, or famine. The Buddha stated categorically that our sense of unease and dissatisfaction with the circumstances of our lives is due to one thing, longing for things to be different than they are. He pointed out that if you remove the major condition on which something arises, that thing must cease to exist. So, to remove the dissatisfaction we experience, we have to eradicate the craving for things to be different than they are. Even though we spend much time in our thoughts, in our hopes and fears, and in our dreams, many of us today have become brainwashed to think that, in the grand scheme of things, mental activities are not as significant or as important as materiality. It never occurs to us that our longing for something better exists only because we do not know. We are ignorant of what lies beyond appearances. This is hardly surprising, for the life of the senses, the material world, is so immediate and so definite. Our contacts with it, whether delightful or painful, lead us to believe that nothing else could be as important. Part of the problem is that the language we use does not deal very comfortably with things of the mind and consciousness. We do not have adequate labels for our interior experiences, and because we can't identify what is happening in there, we cannot describe it, think about it, or approach it in any meaningful way. Any mental health measures we might undertake are likely to be very hit and miss, and mostly miss. We know a lot about the world of the five senses, but very little of mind and consciousness. Knowing so little, we believe and act unwisely, and eventually come to the point where we are more or less forced, by the call of the beyond, to take note of what is, in a very real sense, the most important part of our lives. When we ignore the conscious aspect of the universe, we suffer. When we regard living beings as mere mechanical objects, we suffer. When we adopt the belief that there is only one mechanical life and then oblivion, we suffer. When we believe that satisfying the senses is the be-all and end-all of life, we suffer. When we skimp on love and compassion, we suffer. The Buddha said that suffering and dissatisfaction could be completely eradicated for the individual. We're not talking about world peace here, but rather about individual peace with the world, which is a very different thing. In the third of his Four Noble Truths, he stated, "There is the end of suffering. It is not some mythical state, but real. In one sense, more real than anything else. It is the one true reality. It is what is left when all ignorance, craving, and hatred are eliminated." When we first try to look within, to plumb the depths of being, we can find it very difficult. Unused to reflection of this kind, we lack the capacity to identify clearly the many different aspects of body, mind, and consciousness. While it would certainly be possible to make up some schema of our own, it seems rather like reinventing the wheel. There are already in existence systems of practice that could provide us with a blueprint of the workings of mind and body, and to my mind, the best of these is Buddhadhamma, the teaching of the Buddha. Though there are many equally well-respected teachings that others swear by. The Buddha outlined his system of practice in the fourth truth, the way leading to the eradication of suffering. Of course, some argue that because what we are called to seek, the reality beyond appearances, is beyond conditioning, it is the unborn, uncreate, and unbecome, then any systematic or conditioned approach must fail. They prefer not to adopt a system, a way to the absolute, believing that it will bind them in mental chains and thus obscure the true light. Is this the case? Should we rely on the call of the beyond alone to direct us towards that which we seek? Some say yes. Some say no. It is, in the end, an individual choice. The argument turns on where you wish to start from. Those who advocate no system do nevertheless seek answers to the great questions. Indeed, most of them spend enormous amounts of time pondering over this or that teaching or description of what lies beyond appearances. They try to start from enlightenment as they understand it. It can, however, be very difficult, if not impossible. For example, in London, some of the students I taught were primarily followers of Krishnamurti, who taught no path and no system. Without exception, they came to the centre expressly to learn meditation, which he classified as a hindering system, because they could not make sense of that great teacher's words using the intellect to learn. The Buddha said that there are very few seekers who will come to full understanding on their own without assistance. There are a few who will never come to understanding in this lifetime, no matter how hard they try, because of certain past inefficient actions. And then there are the rest of us. The huge majority of seekers can come to understanding, but only with the assistance in the form of a systematic way to develop insight into reality. That system does ultimately have to be transcended, it is true, as the parable of the raft tells us. But by then, there is a deep understanding of the limitations of the conditioned world, and it is far easier for the mind to turn away from it. So, what are the first steps we need to take when trying to answer the call of the beyond? What do we absolutely have to do, and what extra could we do if we felt strongly enough about it? Initially, we have to learn the essential teachings of the Dhamma. These include the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and condition-dependent origination. Then we are in good shape to think about meditation. One of the first things necessary to prepare for the meditative path is to gain a clear understanding of the things we shall be paying attention to. These are the four foundations of mindfulness: body, feeling, states of mind, and content of mind. We need to enhance our language with new terms, terms that relate to the observation of real experience. This enhancement will provide us with a clear way to apprehend aspects of our lives that were previously invisible because we had no words for them. To be mindful of body is just that. It is to pay attention here and now to the rise and fall of what we are doing physically. We try to be aware when walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, and the changes between these postures. We try to re-establish our attention again and again on the rise and fall of whatever physical actions we are performing at the moment. At the level of sensory impact, we experience materiality, or body, through the senses of touch and sight. To the sense of touch, it is hardness and softness, pressure and temperature. To the sense of sight, it is shape and colour. These too can be observed as they arise and pass away. To be mindful of feelings is to pay attention to the rise and fall of feeling here and now, in distinction from our normal cultural way of looking at things. For meditative purposes, we identify only three feelings: pleasant, painful, and neutral. This simplifies matters greatly and allows us gradually to realize that what we normally have called feeling is a combination consisting of feeling, which is essentially passive and the outcome of past actions, plus the active response to it that we choose to make. This active response is not feeling, it's kamma itself, the action or volition that leads to further resultant feeling. To be mindful of states of mind is to attend constantly to the arising and passing of the different tones that the mind takes on. Such states or tones include the mind that is greedy, hateful, contracted, compassionate, distracted or concentrated, hindered or free from hindrances, and a few others. Once attended to, it is obvious that these states come and go. They rise and fall, surprisingly quickly and often. Even though we think we may have been in a bad mood for a whole day, close observation will prove that the mood is intermittent. It constantly arises and passes away throughout the day. In between, there are other states of mind: distracted or greedy, hindered or unhindered. To be mindful of content of mind is to attend constantly to the arising and passing of individual processes that are part of the functioning of the mind. Again, it helps to have learned the lists that identify them. Among these processes are the individual five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, agitation and flurry, and skeptical doubt. Looking at these, we constantly observe their individual arising and passing throughout the day. We note when one of them is present and when it is absent. We note how it arises and how it ceases. Eventually, we learn exactly how each of the hindrances is overcome and are troubled by them no longer. Other things to pay attention to in this way are the five groups of grasping, the sense bases and their objects, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the four noble truths themselves. This kind of detail may seem daunting at first, but there's no need to panic. As long as we know the lists, by systematically setting up mindfulness of the arising and passing of bodily things, the other three, feelings, states of mind and content of mind, become apparent by themselves. We don't have specifically to go looking for them. Indeed, the very best way to develop mindfulness is to practice systematic mindfulness of body for as much of the time as you possibly can. It really does work. There are two levels to developing our language to include the terms that describe these different aspects of mind and body. The first, as we've seen, is to learn the lists and to understand intellectually what the terms mean. The second level is to develop experiential knowledge of what the terms describe. This is where we actually come to see sensual desire, for instance, in operation. We get to know it firsthand, through experience. When this is done, the whole teaching comes to life in a real and immediate way. It is no longer dry theory, but living practice. Indeed, it is this very endeavour that is the path to freedom. When we have eventually come to full understanding of the Four Noble Truths at the level of experience, there is then no more to do. The way we get from the start of the path to the end is described by the seven stages of purification. It helps greatly to have at least an outline understanding of these also. The first stage is that of bodily and verbal behaviour. We take it on ourselves to observe the five precepts as a lay person or the rules of the order as a monk or nun. So-called pure behaviour is that which creates few ripples in the mind. Essentially, it's the restraint of selfish action. The results are surprisingly beneficial. The Buddha described them, among other things, as removing the five guilty dreads, all of which have to do with the fear of being found out in some less than honourable activity. Restraint really does work. The next step is purification of mind, where we work to overcome the five hindrances to meditation. When these obstacles are overcome, at least some of the time, we are able to observe body and mind free from the disturbances that we habitually introduce through craving, ill will, laziness, agitation or doubt. It can be a revelation to see for yourself just how spacious and tranquil the mind is without these hindering mental habits. In addition, it's extremely beneficial to practice a lot of loving-kindness meditation. When made much of, this serves to counteract the low self-esteem and irritability that many Western meditators otherwise battle with. The next major stage on the way to total freedom from suffering is purification of view, where we learn to see directly how mind and body are made up. We come to see for ourselves the truth of what we've learned earlier. Body is one thing, mind another. All experience consists of an object that arises and the mind that arises to be aware of it. This is always the case. First, there is the arising of an object. Next, and inevitably, mind arises. Through more experience of this kind, we conquer doubt about the teaching, or indeed about our ability to practice the meditation. We see directly several different aspects of mind and body. Here are some of them. We see that before any action can take place, there has to be an intention. We realize that the entire world of experience consists solely of conditioning factors, like intention, and conditioned resultants, like feeling. We come to see for ourselves that any object that arises, mental or physical, is transient, is unsatisfactory, and is non-self. From these experiences, we infer that it has always been so, and will always be so, and that it could never be any different. And while this is still somewhat intellectual, it is nevertheless a true and unmistaken experience of the three marks of all conditioned things. As the practice deepens, we see ever more clearly the arising and passing away of things until the meditation becomes luminous and clear, sharp and agile, with no tangles or obstructions anywhere. Great faith in the teaching arises, and it is at this point that we may well feel the urge to try to convert all our friends and relations to this wonderful way of looking at the world. It seems so significant that some mistake this for the very end of the path, though it would be more properly considered the true beginning of the stream winner's path. We can easily become attached to the different meditative states that now arise and need caution not to get trapped in clinging. After a time, either by our own realization or with help from a teacher, we realize that we are clinging to things that, though delightful, nevertheless corrupt the smooth progress of insight meditation. We let go, we move on. We realize that the path of insight meditation is simply to observe the arising and passing away of mental and bodily objects. It is nothing more and nothing less than this. With this recognition, we apply ourselves afresh. Now arise some insight knowledges that are less than comfortable. We see directly, through experience, the moment-by-moment ending of every mental and physical thing. Seeing this clearly, fear arises as a natural consequence, followed by deep insight into the ultimately miserable and disgusting aspects of all conditioned things. This promotes strong meditative desire to reach the goal. The call of the beyond intensifies greatly, and we apply ourselves to the practice with renewed vigor and precision. With work and time, the meditation gradually stabilizes and a delightful insight knowledge now arises. Equanimity about conditioned phenomena. Now we can take them or leave them. We don't react passionately in any way, even to things that previously may have caused us great distress or pleasure. The meditation is cool, calm, deep and insightful, and the hours pass very quickly and comfortably. As this stage matures, it leads gradually to the very first glimpse of freedom, and the meditator becomes someone who has won to the stream, leading directly to final understanding. The final outcome is now certain. Whether the task is completed in this lifetime or a future one depends on many things. Whatever happens, he or she will eventually come to know the unknown behind appearances, will come to the highest knowledge. When that occurs, the goal is reached, and the call of the beyond is stilled forever. We have responded to the call of the beyond, and in the process examined in great depth the world of matter and consciousness. Now we know, and we have nothing more to do. It is as though we've come home. Now it's obvious why there can be no final freedom in the world, and that in one sense our course of practice was inevitable, given the recognition of the unsatisfactory nature of life as it was. What we have discovered is beyond everything that language can describe. It is beyond even the pristine Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, that brought us this far. We have transcended everything, and the task is truly complete. We are finally at peace, and everything is perfect as it is.